Welcome to PostView. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Pneumococcal and Flu Vaccination Strategies for Improvement conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the one followed by the four on your telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, February the 9th, 2006. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press the star followed by the zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jeff Vodder, Communications Manager for Premier. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Shirley, and greetings, everyone. This is Jeff Vodder reporting from Premier in Charlotte, North Carolina. If you're not familiar with Premier, what we do here is help hospitals improve clinical and financial performance. We have an extremely timely topic today and the two experts to talk about it. I want to welcome you to the program, Pneumococcal and Flu Vaccinations, Strategies for Improvement. We're pleased to have Dr. Dale Bratzler, Kiosk Medical Director for the Oklahoma Foundation for Medical Quality. Dr. Bratzler, would you like to greet the audience?
Yes, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
And we also have Dr. Raymond Strickus, Captain of the U.S. Public Health Service and Associate Director for Adult Immunization for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Strickus.
Thank you very much, and I'm also very pleased to be here.
Just a little about the format today. Drs. Bratzler and Strickus will speak from their experience, and they will also refer to the presentation that we made available on the web for download. Dr. Strickus will go first and then take some Q&A. He has to excuse himself to take care of his patients, and we certainly understand that. And then Dr. Bratzler will go, and then he will also open the lines for some Q&A. We'll have help from our Global Crossing operator, Shirley. If you need assistance during the program, feel free to contact Global Crossing at 800-473-0602. Again, that's 800-473-0602. And at this time, I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Strickus.
Thank you very much again, and then I'm pleased to be here. I'm only sorry that I can only stay a fairly brief period of time because it happened that this call falls on one of the rare days that I do some clinical work and patients are waiting, which is probably familiar to most of the folks on the phone. What I'm going to do is briefly, in 15 minutes or so, review some brief points about influenza pneumococcal disease epidemiology and spend more time outlining what the vaccine recommendations are, how they may change, and a comment as well about influenza vaccine supply issues that might be anticipated for 2006-2007. I have some notes which can be improved, and if they're useful to folks, I can make them available through Mr. Vodder, but I didn't have any slides. The slides you have available are those of Dr. Bratzler, and I'll refer to places where he will probably amplify in a number of the points that I make, in particular with respect to inpatient vaccination and strategies. In addition, the general information on influenza and pneumococcal vaccine recommendations from the U.S. Public Health Service and the CDC are available at this following website, cdc.gov/NIP, and then one scrolls down and looks for the recommendations of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, and you can pick out any number of recommendations, and of course, influenza and pneumococcal vaccines are the ones we're talking about today. If I don't get to answer a question and you wish to email me on this topic or something related, my email is rstrikas, R-S-T-R-I-K-A-S, at cdc.gov. So let me begin by a few comments about influenza disease and vaccine. And influenza, as you're probably mostly aware, has a large burden of disease, the largest of any vaccine-preventable disease in the United States, with an average of over 200,000 hospitalizations and 36,000 deaths per year, most of these in people 65 years of age or older. And these are generally more severe with influenza type A, H3N2 infections. We have two influenza vaccines, and I'll talk about those more a little later, available to us in the United States, an activated vaccine and a live vaccine. But if we take those as an aggregate and say, well, who should receive influenza vaccine on an annual basis, we recommend that for the inactivated vaccine, people who should receive it who are at high risk of complications are all persons 65 years of age or older, persons in nursing homes and chronic care facilities, adults or children with chronic disorders of pulmonary or cardiovascular systems, including asthma, but not hypertension, and other adults and children, that is 6 months of age or older, who have regular medical follow-up for other chronic conditions such as metabolic diseases, renal dysfunction, or immunosuppression from any cause. In addition, a year ago to the recommendations was people who have any condition that can compromise respiratory function or handling respiratory secretions that can increase the risk for aspiration or to increase risk of complications of influenza. So these can be people with spinal cord injuries, seizure disorders, neuromuscular disorders, post-stroke, a variety of things. When added to the risk groups who ought to be vaccinated, and many people were vaccinating them before the recommendation as well. Also, children and adolescents through 18 years of age receiving long-term aspirin therapy could be at risk for experiencing Reye syndrome after influenza infection and should be vaccinated annually, as should be any woman who will be pregnant during influenza season, regardless of the trimester of pregnancy she's in. And again, added a year ago, children 6 to 23 months of age should be vaccinated annually. That comprises about 88 million people, yet our vaccination rates are no better than about 65% or so for people 65 and older, and so we have a lot of work to do. In addition to these groups, people 50 to 64 years of age were added as a group in the year 2000 to be vaccinated annually, because many of them, though not all, have high-risk medical conditions. Many of them are healthcare workers, and many of them are in close contact with individuals who have high-risk conditions. So it was felt to be a good idea to increase vaccination rates by recommending they receive the vaccine. The second group of people, after we talk about high-risk groups, and those 50 to 64, people who can transmit influenza disease to persons at high risk, and these would include healthcare workers with in any clinical setting, also including employees of assisted living and other residences for people in high risk, and people who provide home care to high-risk persons, as well as also household contacts of persons at high risk. And this also includes anyone in contact with children less than 6 months of age, because those children have very high rates of influenza-related hospitalization, but they can't receive the vaccine because no vaccine is licensed for them. So the strategy is to vaccinate the close contacts around them. So that's what we suggest for an activated vaccine. The live attenuated nasal spray vaccine made by the company MedImmune, also called FluMist, is an excellent product. It unfortunately has a limitation in its license, and it can only be given to healthy people 5 to 49 years of age. There is some anticipation, though we don't know for sure, that product will be license may be revised downwards so they could vaccinate children 1 year of age and older. That hasn't happened yet, but we'll see if that happens possibly for 2007. And I'll close a piece on influenza recommendations by reminding you that, as I said, healthcare workers should receive the vaccine. Unfortunately, only about 42% of healthcare workers report receiving influenza vaccine as of 2004. And reasons for this seem to include concerns about adverse events, not knowing that they are at increased risk for influenza infection, and more importantly, perhaps increased risk of transmitting infection to their patients. And so we're concerned that this is low. The Joint Commission is considering issuing recommendations that there be a measurement of vaccination performance in healthcare workers in covered institutions. And CDC, through its Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and another Advisory Committee on Healthcare Infection Control, just issued today on our website at cdc.gov, MMWR, the first thing you'll see is a new publication electronically called Influenza Vaccination of Healthcare Personnel, which summarizes disease burden issues, the coverage data I mentioned, and some strategies to improve vaccination rates in healthcare workers. And I commend that to you if that's an area that you're working on. For 2006, influenza vaccine recommendations for our advisory committee and CDC may include, and these will be discussed in 2 weeks in their meeting on the vaccine, new strains for the vaccine and maybe two strain changes that we won't know till the end of next week when the World Health Organization and our FDA meet to discuss those. There'll be a language reminding practitioners that young children do need two doses of vaccine if they're less than 9 years of age. And if they had a dose in year one, say in 2005 or early 2006, in the fall of 2006, they would only need one additional dose. But they do need two doses to try to prime them and get a good immune response when first being vaccinated. There's a contingency planning section on variable vaccine supply. A challenge we've had for the last several years is the amount of vaccine, as you're all aware, has either been diminished or delayed or both. And we're hoping that this fall, and I'll talk about supply in a moment, we won't be dealing with that, but we'll just have to wait and see. The language in our recommendations will also probably include sort of enhanced language about the ability and desire to vaccinate people in December and later. Traditionally, many folks stopped offering influenza vaccine by the end of November, but we think there's no reason not to vaccinate in December. Influenza season doesn't usually start in the U.S. with any earnest till late December, January, rarely peaks before January, so there's an opportunity to do that. And lastly, that the older antiviral drugs for influenza type A, imantidine or amantadine, no longer seem to be effective. There's a high levels of resistance. This was announced by CDC several weeks ago, and we expect to continue to recommend not using those, but using the newer drugs, the neuraminidase inhibitors, oseltamivir and zanamivir, also known as Tamiflu and Relenza, for influenza prevention and treatment in the United States if you wish to do so. Regarding the supply of the vaccine, the four companies that are presently licensed to bring vaccine in the U.S. and sell it here collectively estimate they'll bring about 100 million doses of vaccine this fall, which is more vaccine than has ever been sold in the U.S. And we would hope if that vaccine is produced near that amount and on time, it has to get here to us by September or so, no later than we hope October, early November, to optimally permit programs for vaccination. That this will alleviate a lot of the concerns about vaccine supply that we've had over the last several years. And as you may be aware, one of the four companies, Sanofi Pasteur, perhaps had the most hullabaloo and loud announcement about their pre-booking or ordering a vaccine for January 31st, and they sold their product out except for a small amount of vaccine for young children in 0.25 milliliter syringes and vials in the course of one day. But the good news is that the Chiron Corporation through seven distributors is still having vaccine available for ordering, and the nasal spray vaccine Flumist is available. GlaxoSmithKline's vaccine was pre-booked and sold to large hospital organizations and long-term care groups a few weeks ago. Also, there may be a new vaccine license. The company called ID Biomedical, now owned by GlaxoSmithKline, is going to apply for a license, we understand, this spring and hope to have it licensed in the next few months, and they could bring an additional 20 million doses of vaccine to the United States. So shifting then to pneumococcal disease, I'll remind you that just talking about invasive disease, bacteremia, meningitis, or sterile space infections, the U.S. estimate for 2004 was over 37,000 cases and 4,900 deaths. Now, for non-invasive disease, primarily pneumonia hospitalizations, older estimates suggest that approaches 180,000 cases of pneumococcal pneumonia each year. Now, pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine is an okay vaccine. It's not the most effective. We'd like better vaccines, as we have the conjugate vaccine for children, but right now we don't have one for adults. And the vaccine, the polysaccharide vaccine, the only one available for adults, is clearly effective in preventing bacteremia and meningitis to a modest degree, 50 to 60% effective, but it's not clear how well it works against non-invasive disease, that is garden variety pneumonia, which is, of course, a very serious problem. However, we do believe the vaccine is important to use, and I'll go over its recommendations. And the recommendations are remarkable more for their similarity than their difference from those for influenza. The differences I'll point out, and there aren't very many, the routine age recommendation, instead of beginning at age 50, is age 65 years of age and older. All persons should receive pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine at least once, and I'll talk about revaccination in a moment. Persons 2 to 64 years of age who have chronic illness may be vaccinated, and these are pretty much the same chronic illnesses as they are for influenza vaccine, except there are no data that people with asthma have an increased risk of pneumococcal disease, so they aren't specifically mentioned as a group to vaccinate with pneumococcal vaccine. An additional group that's highlighted, a couple of additional groups that are highlighted, although there's no reason not to give these folks influenza vaccine, but they're not highlighted in the influenza recommendations, are people with cerebrospinal fluid leaks, people with malfunctioning or missing spleens, and people, those groups can receive influenza vaccine, but they're not named specifically. Another group that's specific to pneumococcal disease and vaccine recommendations are persons, certain Native American populations seem to have increased risk of pneumococcal invasive disease. These include Alaskan Natives and some other American Indian populations, such as the Navajos and others, and these folks should be vaccinated routinely, even if they're otherwise healthy. Which is one exception to the similarity to those recommendations for influenza vaccine. Now, regarding revaccination, which is a source of regular confusion with this vaccine because the recommendations aren't as clear as we might like. There was a lot of concern when the vaccine was first licensed in the late 1970s that some older data and small studies suggested very profound local reactions if you revaccinated people with less than a two-year interval between primary vaccination and revaccination. So initially there was no revaccination recommendation, and then it was in an interval of once at 6 years, and the interval was revised to once at 5 years several years ago. So the recommendation in general is if a person is at very high risk of pneumococcal disease or has an increased risk of losing antibody, this is typically renal failure patients, those on dialysis and the like, those people should be revaccinated one time 5 or more years after the first dose. The concern still exists that we're looking at that subsequent revaccinations may have increased rates of adverse events. To date, that's not been proven. There's some data suggesting third and fourth doses can be safely administered. But also importantly, there are not many data evaluating the degree to which people have protection. Polysaccharide vaccines don't stimulate the immune system as well as protein-based vaccines, which is why conjugation with proteins is common for some of these vaccines. Polysaccharide vaccines, sometimes we see tolerance with a second or third dose, and with pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine, the boosting of antibody after the first vaccination with a second one, there is a boost, but it doesn't go above the level of the first vaccination, which is what you usually expect to see with other vaccines. It rises to near that level. So there is a benefit to revaccination, but it's not clear that that benefit would continue with a third or fourth dose. But these are ongoing issues that are being investigated. So right now the recommendation is one-time revaccination 5 or more years after the first vaccination. Also, our advisory committee says if you don't know the person's status, they don't have a record, they're not able to tell you whether they received this vaccine or not, but they meet the criteria, they should be vaccinated, because the worst thing that's going to happen to them is they'll get a fairly large swollen arm if they've previously been vaccinated. So it is not that you're putting them at profound risk of a very, very serious reaction, but a significant local reaction. Let me pause there, because I do have to get going in a little bit, but I do want to try to take some of your questions over the next few minutes, and then I'll have to defer the rest of the presentation and questions to Dr. Bratzler. But surely I can take some questions now.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for the first question. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4. There are no questions in queue at this time.
Okay, well, I doubt if I've answered all your questions, but I guess you're really waiting for Dr. Bratzler to get more specific about inpatient disease. But let me ask Dr. Bratzler, I may have prompted him to think of a question, something I haven't covered or I touched on and should have amplified. Dale, is there anything I should say in addition?
You basically have covered all the key, questions that I wanted you to cover. I was particularly happy you talked about revaccination, a very, very common question with pneumococcal vaccine, and what to do in those patients for whom there is no history or the patient doesn't know. Right. One question that has come up pretty frequently recently is the issue of the immunosuppressed patients. The 1997 guideline for PPV recommends, the ACIP recommendations are that immunosuppressed patients be vaccinated, and the VIF statement actually states that these patients should be vaccinated.
Right.
There's the competing guideline that was published in 2001, particularly for the bone marrow transplant patients, and that's a confusing issue that's come up lately.
Yeah, and I think, we want to do things that are rational and not just have a knee-jerk response that thou shalt vaccinate or thou shouldn't. And, people evolve, their immune systems evolve, and if they're immune suppressive therapy, you figure they'll be off of it after a while and hopefully be able to respond to vaccination better. So I think all I can say is the more recent recommendations, at least for bone marrow transplant patients, are those in 2001, and they should be considered as the more recent, and that's what you follow for that population. We do think it's very important, and the group that stands out is HIV-infected patients. They clearly have a huge increased risk, perhaps 100-fold higher invasive pneumococcal disease compared to people who don't have HIV infection. And again, even though this is a modestly effective vaccine, it should be offered those patients as soon as you make the diagnosis. But to answer your specific question again, I'd say the more recent recommendations, the BMT recommendations, would supersede the earlier ones in 97. Well, if there aren't any other questions, I'll leave you folks, and either Dale will send your questions to me or Mr. Vauder will at rstrikas, R-S-T-R-I-K-A-S, at cdc.gov, or maybe Dale will answer all the questions and I won't have to. But thank you for your attention. I enjoyed being with you, however, briefly, and I'll excuse myself, and I'll pass the floor to Dr. Bratzler.
Thanks, Ray.
Thank you. Bye.
We really appreciate Ray being here. Ray is incredibly responsive to email questions and things, so if you do have questions, he will get back to you most assuredly. It's my pleasure to be here today. What I'm going to do now is focus specifically on hospital-based vaccination, which I think is what most of you are interested in. As you know, we do have national performance measures that hold hospitals accountable for vaccinating patients in the hospital setting. We do believe this is an incredibly safe practice, and what I hope to do in my presentation is not only show you that it is a safe practice and has been well studied, but also demonstrate that the hospital population is a particularly vulnerable population to the complications of influenza pneumococcal disease, and hence part of the rationale for the national performance measures to encourage inpatient vaccination. I did send out some slides before the call, and I will refer to those as I go through this presentation. There is one slide that I have that's missing from your data set, and I'll just talk my way through that particular slide. So I asked Dr. Strickas just to give you some of the current indications for the vaccines and some information about the epidemiology of the two diseases. Let me first say that when we think about vaccine-preventable disease in the United States, influenza and pneumococcal disease should be considered the big two. When you look at all other vaccine-preventable diseases in the United States, the number of those patients that actually are infected with these other vaccine-preventable diseases or who actually die from vaccine-preventable disease pales when you compare it to the number of people who die from influenza pneumococcal disease. That is unquestioned. Most of the deaths from vaccine-preventable disease in the United States are in the adult population, not in the childhood vaccination. So why should we worry about it in hospitalized patients? And I'll tell you right up front that in an ideal world, all patients would go see their primary care physician or go to the mass vaccination clinic on the corner and get their vaccines in the ambulatory setting. But in that ideal world doesn't exist. We know that that does not happen, and we do focus in this particular national performance measures on vaccination in the hospital. So why should we do it in the hospitals? Well, there are a number of reasons to do it that I'll highlight in just a moment. But I like to go through in my presentation just a series of myths, some of the concerns that I frequently hear or have been raised in the past around inpatient vaccination that hopefully we can work to dispel on this call. The first myth is that the vaccines don't work in hospitalized patients. I get many calls from physicians, hospital systems, and others that say they would prefer to wait until the patient's in the ambulatory setting in their clinic to give the vaccine. They're concerned that the patient was sick and maybe the vaccine won't work as well. Well, frankly, there's really no data to support that particular myth. On slide number 3 in your handout, there's actually nice studies for the influenza vaccine that have compared antibody response levels to vaccine given to patients in the hospital as compared to patients who received the vaccine in the clinic. Bruce Berry did a nice study where he vaccinated a group of patients in the hospital at the time of discharge and also vaccinated a group of patients in his office, monitored the patients for their antibody levels, and basically found no difference in the antibody response to the influenza vaccine for hospitalized patients versus patients seen in the clinic. There's also good data in the chronic renal failure literature that patients on dialysis respond quite well to the influenza vaccine and get good antibody response. And I would also highlight that if you do a literature search, you can actually find quite a bit of data that supports giving influenza vaccine to patients who are receiving chemotherapy. Those patients actually do respond reasonably well, perhaps not as well as an immunocompetent patient, but there are numerous published studies for chemotherapy that patients receiving the influenza vaccine do mount an antibody response. Pneumococcal vaccine, we have less data. I'm not aware of any direct comparisons of ambulatory to hospitalized-based populations, but one thing that we do know is that in patients who come into the hospital and have trauma, particularly motor vehicle accidents and other things that require emergent splenectomy, we oftentimes vaccinate those patients in the hospital and they achieve good antibody response. There's simply no reason to believe that the pneumococcal vaccine doesn't work in this population either, and once again, I'm going to highlight that I think it's particularly important that we vaccinate the hospital population of patients. The vaccines work. They reduce the incidence of disease. Now, many of you may have read the Cochrane reports on both the pneumococcal vaccine and influenza vaccine, and as Dr. Strick has just said, we all agree that we need better vaccines. The vaccines are not ideal. They don't prevent all disease. The vaccines don't work as well in the old elderly as they do in younger patients. And indeed, when Dr. Strick has just led the National Influenza Vaccine Summit that occurred in Atlanta just a couple of weeks ago, one of the big areas of discussion was whether we should retarget vaccination to children, young adults, healthy working adults, or perhaps even having a very aggressive campaign to school-age children to give influenza vaccine, where although those children usually don't die or have severe complications of influenza when they get it, they act as a reservoir that transmits it to our older patients who are more likely to have complications of the disease. On slide number 4, you see a very nice study that was done by Dr. Kristen Nickel, published in the New England Journal in 2003, with almost 300,000 patients from managed care organizations. These were all patients that were 65 years of age and older. And they looked, this is a nice population-based study that compared vaccinated to unvaccinated patients. And essentially showed that there were reduced hospitalizations for pneumonia, cardiac reasons, reduced hospitalization for cerebrovascular disease, and consistent with almost every other population-based study that's compared vaccinated to unvaccinated patients, about a 50% reduction in the mortality rate, and that held up across all the age groups. Now, recognize the vaccine does not work as well in a patient that's 85 as it does in a patient that's 65, and we recognize that in population-based studies, this is not a randomized controlled trial. There may be other factors that are not measurable in this particular study. However, Dr. Nickel also looked at the mortality group, the mortality for these two groups of patients during the summertime when you would not expect influenza to have any impact, and there was no difference in the mortality rate for the same group of patients during the summer. It was only, the vaccine was only protective during the flu season of the year. So, though the randomized trials, which have been relatively limited, most have had methodologic flaws, and rarely have they had the sample size sufficient to look at the impact of the influenza vaccine, those randomized trials often have not shown substantial reductions in mortality. When you look at large population-based studies, they typically have. Similarly, for the pneumococcal vaccine, as Dr. Strick has pointed out, the vaccine is anywhere from 50 up to 75% effective at preventing invasive disease, bloodstream infections, meningitis, as he pointed out, infections of sterile sites. It's not very good at preventing pneumonia. In fact, most studies have not shown that it's very effective at preventing pneumonia. A nice review of the pneumococcal vaccine literature by the Cochrane Group, again, demonstrated that the randomized trials have not shown reductions in pneumonia. However, and there were a number of articles that came out about that Cochrane review that questioned the value of the pneumococcal vaccine. However, if you read on through the entire Cochrane report, in the second portion, they reviewed all the epidemiologic population-based surveys. They highlighted the fact that in all of those surveys, pneumococcal vaccine has reduced bacteremia, and they even pointed out that a randomized clinical trial would be considered unethical and not likely to be approved because of the population-based study showing reductions in bacteremia. One study that did show reduced hospitalization for pneumonia, and it's the only one that I'm familiar with recently, was published by Kristen Nickel again, and it was only limited to a group of patients with chronic lung disease. In that particular study, there were reductions in hospitalizations for pneumonia. The most recent study, population-based, that was done came out of the Group Health Cooperative in Seattle with about 50,000 patients. Once again, pneumococcal vaccine was associated with lower rates of bacteremia, about a 50% reduction. It was not associated with lower rates of community-acquired pneumonia. So I'm always cautious and ask healthcare workers as they provide the pneumococcal vaccine to not promote this as a pneumonia vaccine, because the data really does not support that. This vaccine is to prevent the severe complications, bacteremia and meningitis primarily. So as Dr. Strick has pointed out very well, we need better vaccines. We have the conjugated vaccine in children now, which appears to be quite effective for pneumococcal disease. Interestingly, one of the things that we've seen now is as more children have been vaccinated against pneumococcal disease, we're seeing fewer cases of invasive pneumococcal disease in adults. Once again, highlighting the fact that perhaps immunization strategies really need to target children, school-age children and others that are often vectors for these diseases, though they don't get nearly as sick as adults do, they often can spread the infection to adults. The other thing that I think is really exciting, Dr. Strick has mentioned that next year we're anticipating a much, much larger supply of influenza vaccine. And the other really fun thing, I think, is that we're going to see new vaccines on the market. Recombinant technology, cell-based production of vaccines will shorten the time frame from identification of a viral strain to actually production of a vaccine. Current vaccine manufacturing is completely based on the use of cultures and chicken eggs. It's a very slow process. It's highly fraught with numerous errors. That's what happened to Chiron last year. And we need better vaccines. There are interesting vaccines where they've actually increased the concentration of the antigens in the vaccine. And I think what's exciting about that is some of these vaccines produce higher antibody responses. So perhaps we'll have newer vaccines that are more concentrated and may even work better in the old elderly. So I specifically asked Dr. Strickus a question about immunosuppression because it's a common question. I frequently get questions about patients that are receiving chemotherapy or patients that are immunosuppressed for one reason or another, patients taking corticosteroids, about whether or not they should be vaccinated. And as Dr. Strickus pointed out on slide number 9, immunocompromised patients, if you read the Advisory Committee on Immunization recommendations for these vaccines, they specifically recommend that these patients be vaccinated. As Dr. Strickus mentioned, for invasive pneumococcal disease, HIV patients are 100-fold more likely to have invasive complications of pneumococcal disease than immunocompetent patients. Patients with leukemia, lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, and many others should receive vaccine. Patients on chemotherapy and those that have had organ transplants and bone marrow transplants. Influenza vaccine, specifically, it's recommended that immunosuppression caused by medications or by HIV, those patients be vaccinated. Now, recently we made one change to the national performance measure that many of you may be aware of. We had a number of conversations with Dr. Strickus and many of his colleagues at the National Immunization Program in Atlanta about, you know, the strength of evidence around vaccination of patients receiving chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and bone marrow transplants. And as Dr. Strickus mentioned for me, in 2001, CDC, the Infectious Disease Society of America, and others published a guideline suggesting that while there is no danger in giving vaccines to patients who have had bone marrow transplantation, there's no risk, the vaccines are simply less likely to be effective. So they recommend that you wait 6 months after bone marrow transplant for influenza vaccine and 1 year for the pneumococcal vaccine. So when we modified the performance measure, we basically said that any patient that had had a bone marrow transplant within 1 year would be, we would consider that a contraindication to vaccination, and your case can pass if they're not vaccinated. We also, particularly for the pneumococcal vaccine, exclude patients who are actively receiving chemotherapy or radiation therapy, not because we think there's any danger at all, but simply that there's just very little data about the effectiveness of the vaccine when patients are being actively treated with chemotherapy. That contrast with influenza vaccine, where there's good data that patients do mount an antibody response and most importantly, the time frame for which you can actually get a patient vaccinated with the influenza vaccine is short, so we don't want to delay it, even in an immunocompromised patient. Another myth that happens, that comes up frequently when we talk with medical staffs or hospitals and others around the country, is that concern about vaccination not being safe for patients in the hospital. The old concern that vaccination can make you sick, which is not the case, but just simply concern that it's just not safe to vaccinate a patient in the hospital. After all, you've got a patient laying in a hospital bed that's recovering from an acute illness. Why in the world would you want to give them the vaccine? Well, largely, there's no rationale, or there's no evidence to support that it's not safe to do so. Indeed, if you look at slide number 11, you can see I've listed a number of the articles, and there are a bunch more now, that have basically highlighted the fact that it's incredibly safe to give influenza vaccine and pneumococcal vaccine to patients in the hospital. There have been published emergency department-based vaccination programs. All of these have been very safely and effectively implemented with no reports of any significant risk. I just visited a hospital this past week that's given more than 5,000 doses now of pneumococcal vaccine. They do a fairly good job of monitoring their patients. They're in a relatively small community, so they have fairly good follow-up on most of their patients. And they've documented a couple of sore arms with the pneumococcal vaccine, but no other substantial side effects. It's just, these vaccines are incredibly safe. The risk of side effects are incredibly low. In a nice study done by Margolis and Nickelback, published back in 1990, on slide 12, they looked at the incidence of vaccine symptoms or post-injection symptoms in a group of patients. These were elderly patients. Half the patients got vaccine. They were randomized to either vaccine or a placebo injection. One of the interesting things from this study, when they did subjective surveys of the patients and asked them, did you get the flu from the flu shot, the same number of patients who received the placebo injection got the flu from their placebo injection as the patients who got the actual vaccine. There was absolutely no difference in perceived symptoms. But when you actually look at real symptoms that were recorded, you can see that there was no difference in any symptom between the groups that got real vaccine and those that got a placebo injection, except for sore arm. And any of you that are healthcare workers that have received the influenza vaccine know that sometimes you get some muscle aches at the site of injection. That was the only symptom that was different. Fever was not a side effect of the vaccine in this population. And indeed, elderly patients are much less likely to have any systemic symptoms whatsoever from the vaccine. So I frequently am asked by surgeons and others, should we vaccinate postoperative patients? We don't want to mask another infection by causing them to have a post-vaccination fever. And frankly, I can show them this data and talk to them. There are other studies that simply show that fever is not a common side effect from these vaccines. On slide 13 is another study that was done, a little bit different study. They did a survey of the patients pre-vaccination, asked them what symptoms they were complaining of. They then gave them the pneumococcal vaccine and then resurveyed the patients about their symptoms. And it turns out that most of the patients had fewer symptoms after injection of the pneumococcal vaccine than those patients had before they received the pneumococcal vaccine. Once again, most of the symptoms were reduced. There was no increase in any symptom post-pneumococcal vaccination. I think the pneumococcal vaccine is incredibly safe. The risk of side effect, the biggest side effect is the arthritis type 3 reaction, that local injection site reaction that Dr. Strickus mentioned that causes swelling of the arm at the injection site. When I see that, I know that patient has high circulating anti-streptococcal strep pneumo antibodies circulating, and they've just simply mounted a good antibody antigen reaction. It's a local reaction. It's not an allergy. It's self-limited. It is more common in a young patient that's revaccinated. It's uncommon in the elderly. Now, I have a slide that you can't see, you don't have in your slide set. For some reason, it shows up on my screen, but when I sent it to Premier, it did not show up. But I want to highlight one other point that I think is really important, because I know all of you have had some patients tell you that they got the flu from the flu shot. And the slide, and hopefully it'll be made available to you, on the particular slide, I have the months of the year shaded during which we give the influenza vaccine. And the point of the slide is it shows that there are other viruses that peak in terms of their activity at the same time, particularly respiratory syncytial virus, which the influenza vaccine will not prevent, and parainfluenza viruses, which the influenza vaccine will not prevent. Both of those viral infections are associated with symptoms that can mimic influenza, though the patients don't get nearly as sick. However, since the vaccine is given around the same time, and the patients can potentially be infected with these other viruses, it's important to recognize that undoubtedly patients can have other viral infections about the same time that you give the influenza vaccine, have fever symptoms and other symptoms that they may perceive as the flu but really aren't the flu. There is no way using the inactivated injectable vaccine to have any symptoms related to influenza. You can't get the flu from the flu shot. So on slide 14, I just point out vaccination reality in the United States. Despite the fact that we have vaccines that are clinically effective, they're not perfect by any means, but they're better than not being given. They're cost effective. Numerous studies have shown that they reduce healthcare costs. They're quite safe, and they're free to most elderly patients because the Medicare program pays for them. Even in the inpatient setting, they do not require you to take this out of your DRG. They're underutilized, as Dr. Strick has mentioned. Only about 65% of Americans each year that are in the high risk in the elderly category get the influenza vaccine. It's even lower when you go below the age of 65. For high-risk patients below the age of 50, it's quite low. For healthcare workers, only about 36% take the vaccine. For pneumococcal vaccine, only about two-thirds of the population of patients above the age of 65 have ever had the pneumococcal vaccine, so we still have a lot of room to go. We have good vaccines. They're not perfect. They're cost-effective. They're almost always free, but they're underutilized. We don't do a very good job. So on the next slide, I simply want to highlight, why should we vaccinate hospitalized patients? Why is the CMS and Joint Commission have national performance measures here? Why should we focus on the hospitalized patient? Well, on slide number 16, you see a study that came from Dr. David Fedson. This was done in Manitoba, Canada, a number of years ago. In the first column, you see the age groups that he studied. In the second column, you see the population of patients that he studied. So if you just look at the second column, 297,000 patients that were between the ages of 25 and 44. Above the age of 75 in Manitoba at that time, there were 44,000 patients. The third column represents the number of patients who actually ended up in the hospital during flu season. So of those 297,000 patients that were between the age of 25 to 44, 8,046 of those patients were in the hospital, 3% of them. However, as you would expect, the older age group, 44,000 patients only in the population, 5,000 of them, 12% of them, ended up in the hospital during flu season. But then jump over to the far right-hand column. This is the percentage of people who actually subsequently died from complications of pneumonia and influenza. 65% of the people between the ages of 25 and 44 who died from pneumonia or influenza were among that 8,000 patients that were in the hospital. Similarly, for the 75 and older age group, 66% of the patients that died from complications of pneumonia and influenza had been in the hospital, where 66% of those patients were in that group of 5,188 that were in the hospital during the flu season. It seems that hospitalization identifies a group of patients that are particularly high risk of influenza, of the subsequent complications of pneumonia and influenza that frequently occurs when patients get the infection. So approximately two-thirds of the people who died from pneumonia and influenza had been in the hospital during the previous flu season. Hospitalization seems to identify a high-risk population. On the next slide, number 17, you see what's called the epidemiologic rationale for hospital-based pneumococcal vaccination. And there have been a number of different studies that have been published. And just look at the far right-hand column. This is the proportion of people who died from pneumococcal disease who had been previously hospitalized within the past 3 to 5 years. Some studies used 3 years, some studies used 5 years. But it ranged anywhere from 49 to 78%. when you look at the people who died of the complications of pneumococcal disease, many of them, half to three-quarters of them, had been in the hospital during the previous 3 to 5 years. So clearly, hospitalization, again, seems to identify a group of patients that may be at particularly high risk of the complications of pneumococcal disease. So why give them in the hospital? Well, it's a potential missed opportunity. Hospitalized patients may be at particular risk of complications of influenza pneumococcal disease. And one thing that I haven't shown, but in almost every study that's looked at vaccination rates for patients that are admitted to the hospital, they tend to be lower than vaccination rates seen in the general population. Now, we don't know why that is, but it may be that patients who are sick enough to end up in the hospital may be a population of patients that don't routinely get to see their primary care physician. Maybe they're not ambulatory. Maybe they're not followed up as well. We don't know exactly why. But when you look at most studies that have looked at the vaccination status of patients when they come into the hospital, they tend to systematically, it appears, have a lower vaccination rate than patients from the general community. So you have a population of patients in the hospital that tend to have a lower vaccination rate, and you have a population of patients in the hospital that then subsequently tend to be at higher risk of subsequent complications of influenza and pneumococcal disease. So it seems like a population of patients we really ought to target. So is it the standard of care? On slide number 19, I simply highlight why I believe it has become the standard of care. Recognize that both the Medicare program and the Joint Commission have adopted influenza pneumococcal vaccination of inpatients as measures of hospital quality. Secondly, as you all know, Congress wrote the pneumococcal vaccine into the Medicare Modernization Act as a publicly reported measure of hospital quality. You can go online today to the Hospital Compare website and see the rates of pneumococcal vaccination for pneumonia patients for almost every hospital in the nation. Congress wrote it into the Medicare Modernization Act. Most hospitals are reporting it because if you don't report it, your payment rate is lower. Also recognize that many, many different professional organizations, including the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and others, recommend that hospital-based vaccination be a strategy to improve vaccination rates. It's recommended in the IDSA pneumonia guidelines. It's recommended by the American Hospital Association, their infection committee. It's recommended by many different organizations. So I believe it is the standard of care that we do this. So just to highlight the two performance measures, the first one is pneumococcal vaccination. And I'll just highlight the numerator. The numerator is patients with pneumonia, age 65 years of age and older, who were screened for pneumococcal vaccine status and were vaccinated prior to discharge if indicated. So for this particular measure, there are only four ways to get into the numerator. The first way is to give the vaccine. If the patient's not previously vaccinated, if you vaccinate them while they're in the hospital, you pass the measure. The second way is to document that the patient's already had it. The third way is to document that there's a specific contraindication to the vaccination, which I will tell you are rare. There are almost none. And the fourth way is that the patient simply refuses to be vaccinated. And I'll show you in just a moment that's very uncommon. Of course, the denominator for this measure is pneumonia patients age 65 years of age and older. Now, I would highlight that as you build an in-patient vaccination program in your hospital, that you focus on more than just the patients age 65 years of age and older, that you look at the ACIP recommendations and make sure that all splenectomy patients, all diabetics, all patients with cerebrospinal fluid leaks, any patients that are alcoholic or have liver disease, patients with renal failure, you make sure that you vaccinate those patients also because they are a high-risk population and there may be liability risk if you don't. PN7, influenza vaccination, the performance measure on slide 21, is the number of patients discharged during the month of October through February with pneumonia, age 50 and over, who were screened for influenza vaccination status and were vaccinated prior to discharge if indicated. The only four ways you can get into the numerator is to give the influenza vaccine or to document that it was already given or to document a true contraindication. And about the only true contraindication is an anaphylactic egg allergy, or the fourth one would be the patient refuses. So these are the vaccine measures. Once again, the influenza vaccine measure runs October through February. And we know that a number of hospitals have reported to us that they ran out of vaccine, but as Dr. Strick has pointed out, Chiron alone most recently reported that they still had 1.5 million unsold doses in the United States, and they have distributors that are actively distributing the vaccine. So at this point, CMS and Joint Commission do not plan to suppress public reporting of this measure for the months of January and February, though they will suppress reporting most likely for the months of October, November, and December during this past flu season because of the delay in delivery of the vaccine. But the vaccine is out there. It is obtainable. Now, I mentioned some of this before. We exclude patients who have had a bone marrow transplant within the past year, and from the pneumococcal measure, patients actively receiving chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And just once again to highlight, there is now a new variable in the tools called influenza vaccine not available. However, we only allow the vendors to use this variable if there's a true national shortage of vaccine. And that actually did not happen this past year. There were more than 85 million doses of vaccine available in the United States. There are still doses on the market. So that allowable value is only used and can only be used when there is a true national shortage of vaccine. Well, on slide number 23, you can see we've been trending vaccination. I actually have more recent data that I have not updated the slide, but it simply shows that when I last looked at data, this goes through the second quarter of 2004, patients rarely refuse the vaccine. There rarely is a documented contraindication, but most of the improvement in the performance measure has been around screening, documenting that the patient had had the vaccine prior to admission. The important point through the second quarter of 2004 was that more than 61% of patients had no documentation in their chart of their influenza vaccination status. So there's still plenty of opportunity for improvement. Also, the number of vaccine doses given in the hospital was still relatively low, though that number is now growing. Pneumococcal vaccine on slide number 24, we've seen, once again, refusals uncommon, contraindications rare. The number of doses is continually going up. The most recent data I have from fourth quarter of 2004 was that about 10,000 doses of pneumococcal vaccine were given in the hospital during that quarter, and that number continues to grow. Once again, however, many patients still have no documentation in the medical record. So where are we at now? Targeted efforts to improve and measure performance have resulted in improved documentation, I think. We're doing a better job of documenting the patient's vaccination status. However, the overall rates of inpatient vaccination have only marginally improved. They are going up, but not very fast. And many of the patients, when we look at charts, we still find no documentation of vaccination status for more than half of the Medicare patients discharged from the hospital. So there are still plenty of opportunities for improvement. Refusals and contraindications account for a very small proportion of the improvement nationally in vaccination and screening of this population of patients. You know, it's just not a common reason to not give the vaccine. Well, let me highlight one other issue that I think is important that you're all aware of. On slide number 28 is an article that we published back in 2002. The title was Failure to Vaccinate Medicare Inpatients, and we simply highlighted what was happening in the Medicare population in 1998-1999, demonstrated that many patients coming into the hospital had not been vaccinated before. They came to the hospital. Vaccines were rarely being given to those patients in the hospital. And the other key point that we documented was that if you didn't do it while they were there and it hadn't been done before they came into the hospital, they usually were not vaccinated after they went home. Only 10% of the patients got the influenza vaccine after they left the hospital, and only 1 to 2% got the pneumococcal vaccine after discharge. So one of the important findings here was that the hospitalization was the missed opportunity, because it was not likely to occur after they went home, despite best intentions to do it in the clinic. Well, we wrote the article to publicize the need to do a better job of doing inpatient vaccination, but as you might expect, plaintiff's attorneys found out about the study and some other issues. And on slide number 29, you can see that I believe the liability risk associated with these vaccines is in failure to vaccinate, not in concerns about vaccine side effects, which are exceedingly rare. So I am aware of liability cases in three states. Interestingly, none of them were in Medicare age group patients, and that's why I pointed out that although the performance measure for PPV focuses on the Medicare age group population, I think the program that you document and implement in your hospital should target your entire population of patients who are at risk. In these three cases, all three of them were young men. All of them had a splenectomy, and none of them was there any documentation that PPV was given or offered. Each of these men then had a subsequent hospitalization. One of the patients I know of at least three hospitalizations. In none of those hospitalizations were they screened for or given the pneumococcal vaccine. One of the patients visited the primary care physicians and also visited an emergency room, were not given PPV. And then, after these multiple admissions or visits in ambulatory centers, all three of these young men developed pneumococcal bacteremia, bloodstream infections, and they developed something called purpura fulminans, which is a peripheral coagulopathy that causes peripheral gangrene. So two of them had significant amputations. One of them had meningitis and renal failure. One patient was on a ventilator for a prolonged period of time. One of them died. In two of the cases, there have been settlements, or in two of the cases, there have been actions against the hospitals. On the next slide, number 30, I guess it is, Montana, a family won $1.3 million jury verdict against the hospital. Because of this, the patient was not vaccinated in the hospital setting. And as the plaintiff's attorney basically said, jury verdict would send a message to the hospital that it was focusing on the wrong areas for cost savings. The teenager's last day in the hospital, the charge for the last day in the intensive care and all the things that were done was $18,000, and of course the vaccine would have cost $25. One other case was occurred in another state where three hospitals, primary care doctors, and an emergency room physician were all sued, or emergency room group were all sued, and there was a large settlement. I don't know the exact details, but I'm just simply told that the family was happy with the settlement. So I think there is significant liability risk in failing to do this. Well, on slide number 31, you can see the national performance rates. This is some of the most recent data we have. You can see, I want to focus on the benchmarks. Benchmark hospitals, 83% of the time screen for or give the influenza vaccination, 93% of the time give pneumococcal vaccine. Now, these are based on the achievable benchmark of care methodology, and these particular data highlight the fact that these are averages. These are not a hospital's benchmark rate. This is the average performance of the top 10% of the hospitals. And you can see that there are substantial opportunity for improvement across the nation, but some hospitals are doing a very good job of providing immunization services before patients go home. So to kind of end my formal comments, how should we go about making sure that patients get vaccinated, and where should we do it? Well, I think we need to vaccinate patients anywhere we find chronically ill patients, patients that are elderly, or high-risk patients for that matter. Clearly, doing it in the hospital alone will not substantially impact the major problems that we have around vaccination of adults in particular, but it's one step, one strategy for a high-risk population. A number of studies have looked at strategies to improve institutional vaccination rates. One done by RAND ranked the strategies from organizational change down to the least effective, which was assessment and feedback. Organizational change was the most effective, and the most common organizational change was the implementation of standing orders. Provider reminders work. Things like patient education, patient or provider education, was not particularly useful in terms of improving vaccination rates. So what are standing orders programs? Well, this is actually a CDC definition. Standing orders programs authorize nurses or pharmacists, it depends on state law whether pharmacists can give vaccines or not, to administer vaccinations according to an institution or physician-approved protocol without a physician's examination. I would ask each of you to look within your own state, and you probably recognize that patients go into public health clinics, city and county health departments all the time. Children receive vaccines, adults receive vaccines all the time in those settings, and there are no doctors inside anywhere near the building. It doesn't take a physician to give an influenza vaccine or a pneumococcal vaccine, and indeed nurses in public health clinics do it all over the country every single day. So there's no reason to think that we can't do a similar practice in hospitals, nursing homes, and in within home health agencies. Well, what are standing orders then, or how do you implement them? Basically, most places use some type of a checkoff list, and on slide number 35, I have one that I pulled off the CDC website. You check a box about whether the patient has a high-risk category, and then somebody screens the patient, the nurse screens the patient for contraindications, and if the patient has an indication and no contraindication, the patient is vaccinated without the need for individual physician involvement at the time that the vaccination is given. In Colorado, on slide number 36, they've actually come together and created the Colorado Clinical Guidelines Collaboration, and they've created some standardized standing orders for both influenza and pneumococcal vaccines that healthcare providers across the state can use to vaccinate patients to improve vaccination rates. Slide number 37, in Florida, the Medicare QIO in that state has been monitoring vaccination rates for some of their hospitals that have implemented programs. And what they have found is that those hospitals that have implemented formal standing order protocols have higher vaccination rates than those hospitals that have no specific process, that usually rely on physician memory to order the vaccine. So once again, having that systems-based strategy to improve vaccination rates appears to be the most effective way to increase vaccination rates. We did change federal law back in October of 2002, and remember that all medications in a hospital chart have to, you know, you have to have a written order for those, and it has to be signed by the practitioner responsible for the care of the patient, but we created an exception for influenza pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccines. So as long as you have a physician-approved facility policy, so it could be your medical director, it could be the medical staff, it could be the board of directors, but once you have an approved facility policy that includes some type of an assessment for contraindications, and like I say, most institutions use some type of a form that nurses use or pharmacists use, you may give influenza pneumococcal vaccines without a signed physician order. It does not require a signature. This will change in the conditions of participation applied to nursing homes, home health agencies, and hospitals. Now, I recognize there are some questions around local state laws, and that's something that each of you have to identify. Most state laws that we've examined simply don't address standing orders programs at all. So when you go into a state, you find no documentation in state law about the use of standing orders. We know the nurses out in the county health departments are doing it every day with no law that addresses them. And yet sometimes when attorneys are asked or legal counsel is asked in a hospital setting, they question whether it's okay to give hospital-based vaccinations. So many states now are starting to address this, but just recognize that standing orders are used in almost every state every single day. I think there's some good opportunities for cross-cutting quality improvement initiatives. Remember that nursing homes are now being held accountable for offering vaccination to their patients. This hospital that I mentioned to you has given more than 5,000 doses of pneumococcal vaccine has started working with the local nursing homes because they have a rather limited group of nursing homes that routinely refer patients to them to get information about vaccination status or to make sure that they have transfer of information when patients are admitted to the hospital so that the nurses aren't guessing about prior vaccination status. Remember also that home health agencies now are being encouraged to screen patients for influenza pneumococcal vaccination status and vaccinate them when they have not received them before. And so I think there's some good opportunities for cross-cutting initiatives between home health agencies and hospitals. Home health agencies are now held accountable for readmission rates back to the hospital after a patient is discharged. And so we know that patients who receive things like the influenza vaccine are less likely to be readmitted to the hospital. And finally, mass vaccinators may be willing to work with you as you implement programs to try to ensure that you get high rates of community-based vaccination. Dr. Strick has made the point, I'll make it again, annual influenza vaccination is recommended for all persons who work in any medical care facility, provide care in any setting to persons at increased risk of influenza or complications of influenza. We don't do a very good job of this, vaccinating healthcare workers. Only about 36% of healthcare workers in most recent surveys have received the influenza vaccine. Many of you may have seen the recent article about Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle, which is now has a policy of requiring all employees to be vaccinated as a condition of employment. And this is for patient protection. Most healthcare workers, if they get influenza, they may miss a few days of work, which is not good for a hospital facility, particularly during flu season when hospitals tend to be busy. But the bigger issue is that an infected healthcare worker, and remember that you're often infectious for at least a day or so before you have symptoms, those healthcare workers can spread the virus and infect patients. And there are well-documented outbreaks in hospitals and nursing homes of infected healthcare workers causing patient injury because of this. So healthcare workers should definitely take the influenza vaccine on an annual basis. On slide number 41, once again, just to simply highlight, influenza and pneumococcal disease are the big two. This is 10 years worth of data looking at the number of deaths due to influenza and pneumococcal disease. And you can argue about whether the number should be 510,000 or whether it should be 360,000 for influenza, and argue about whether it's 120,000 or 60,000 deaths due to pneumococcal disease. The reality is that any way you look at the data, influenza and pneumococcal disease kill more Americans than all other vaccine-preventable diseases combined. And I always highlight tetanus, because I can assure you that if I come into any of your emergency rooms and I have a cut or I step on a nail, I'll be asked several times about my tetanus vaccine status. It'll be documented in the chart, and very likely I will receive the tetanus vaccine as almost a standard of care. Even if I'd had one recently, they might recommend a booster. Well, only about 7 patients a year in the United States die of complications of tetanus. But look at the diabetic patient that comes into your emergency room, or the young males that I mentioned to you that had a prior splenectomy, where the risk of death is extremely high from influenza pneumococcal disease. How often do we make sure that they've had the influenza pneumococcal disease? Our vaccination priorities are good in children, and the reason that we see relatively low rates of many of these diseases is because we do a good job with childhood vaccines. Not perfect, but we do a reasonably good job, but we don't do a good job with the adults. And we need to focus our efforts there. Dr. Greg Polin, a couple of years ago, wrote an editorial, "If you could have the mortality rate, would you do it?" He was highlighting the point from so many different studies that when you compare vaccinated to unvaccinated populations with the influenza vaccine, almost every single one of these population-based studies has shown the reduction in the mortality rate by about 50%. Now, how many interventions do we have in medicine that can have the mortality rate? There aren't many. And he just simply chiding us that, you know, why are we not doing this? Why don't we make this more routine? We need to do a better job for the diseases that really are killing patients. So in summary, vaccination rates for some of our most vulnerable patients are unacceptably low. I hope I've made the point, and the reason that we have CMS and Joint Commission measures on inpatient vaccination is that we believe strongly that hospitalized patients may systematically have lower vaccination rates than patients in the general population, but more importantly, those patients are at particular risk of the subsequent complications of influenza and pneumococcal disease. Vaccination in these settings is effective. We know that patients get antibody response, and perhaps more important for you, vaccination in these settings is incredibly safe. I really firmly believe, of all the things that I've done as a hospitalist and in private practice, that these vaccines are as safe as any medicines I give and probably safer than most. And yet, you know, we go through all sorts of contortions around consent and calling patients and families and doing all sorts of things that impede vaccination rates, and yet we'll hang, you know, a cephalosporin IV antibiotic, or we'll give an IV push of lanoxin or another drug where the complication risks are much, much higher And yet we never worry about consent and all sorts of protocols there. And finally, we know clearly that systems-based interventions are the best way to improve vaccination rates. Just measuring performance, just doing education doesn't help. You have to do something on a systematic basis, like implementing standing orders programs, implementing electronic reminder systems, other things that have been shown to improve vaccination rates. At this point, Jeff, I'll stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. It's certainly my pleasure to be here.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Bratzler. Now, we do invite everyone listening to ask Dr. Bratzler questions, or you can comment on what we've discussed, and feel free to share interesting things that you're doing at your own facility. Just please remember to tell us your name and where you're calling from, and surely our coordinator will facilitate.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4. Our first question comes from the line of Steven Schwann, St. Luke's Hospital. Please proceed.
Hi, this is a question for Dr. Bratzler. Actually, I was hoping to ask my question earlier to Dr. Strickitz, but it's pertaining to pertussis vaccine. If ACIP will be discussing pertussis vaccine for hospital workers in 2 weeks, and number two, is there any discussions about offering pertussis vaccine to adult hospitalized patients in the near future?
And I will send that question to Dr. Strickitz because I honestly don't know if that's on the ACIP agenda or not. I really cannot. At this point, CMS and Joint Commission have not discussed pertussis vaccine at all with respect to hospitalized patients, but I am aware of some of the literature on increasing rates, but I can't answer your other questions.
Thank you.
We will get that back to you. Shirley, do we have our next question, please?
Our next question comes from the line of Becky Borman, Lynette Hospital System. Please proceed. Ms. Borman, your line is now open.
Is that Borland?
Hello?
It is you. Your line is open.
Dr. Bratzler, you talked about a low antibody response for the pneumococcal vaccine for patients receiving chemo or radiation. But what about when the patient's in neutropenic?
Well, once again, when you look at the ACIP recommendations for both of the vaccines, it's recommended that patients who are immunosuppressed be vaccinated. We decided, because the window of opportunity for pneumococcal vaccine is much greater than it is for influenza, CDC recommended that patients actively receiving chemotherapy or radiation therapy in the hospital setting, that we exempt those cases from vaccine. For influenza vaccine, though, they did not want that recommendation to be in place. First, there is pretty good data that influenza vaccine works in patients who are actively receiving chemotherapy. And I actually can't tell you whether or not – I actually don't think neutropenia in and of itself is the bigger issue. It's whether or not the patient's going to respond with an antibody response to the vaccine. But there's quite a bit of published data in chemotherapy patients that they do respond to the influenza vaccine. And because the window of time for those patients to get vaccinated is relatively short, CDC recommends that we go ahead and get them vaccinated whenever you have the opportunity. So we don't exempt patients with neutropenia alone. For pneumococcal vaccine, we do. For both influenza and pneumococcal vaccine, bone marrow transplants, we exempt. And for patients receiving actively chemotherapy radiation for the pneumococcal vaccine, we also consider that a, quote, contraindication. It's really not a contraindication. There's no risk. It's just a question of whether or not you'll get a good response to the vaccine.
Thank you.
Have our next question, please.
Our next question comes from the line of Marjorie Keith, Bay State Medical Center. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, my name is Betty Lemke at Bay State Medical Center. I have a question. We currently, in our practice, vaccinate patients on the day of discharge or the day before discharge. Would it be possible to vaccinate them earlier in their hospital stay, maybe the day after admission, especially if they have any symptoms like fever or high white count?
Yeah, that's a real good question, a common question. Anything I tell you here is opinion-based because there are no data on comparing, you know, early versus late hospital vaccination. I'm just not aware of any data. As a clinician, I'm quite comfortable vaccinating a patient at any point that they're clinically stable. I tend to not vaccinate hypotensive patients, patients in the ICU and things like that, but many hospitals around the country have moved the vaccination program up earlier during the hospital stay because what they found as they implemented these programs that patients were often being missed when they waited until the day of discharge. So a number of hospitals now have implemented programs where patients are vaccinated on day two or three of the hospital stay and have not reported any problems with that strategy. In terms of fever, there is no particular number or fever that above which, you know, vaccination is clearly not recommended. If you look at the package inserts, it says patients recovering from febrile illness should not be vaccinated, but they don't provide any data to support that statement. We're actually working with one of the vaccine manufacturers now to change the package insert to get some of that language out of there because we believe that some people are using it as justification for not vaccinating patients, and frankly, the statements are based on no published data that we can find. So I'm comfortable if the patient is clinically stable, but there's no data, I don't think, to compare early versus late hospital vaccination.
Thank you.
Okay, let's have our next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Michelle Bushy, Bon Secours St. Francis. Please proceed.
Yes, Dr. Bradford, just a clarification, and maybe you answered this already, but I'm away. We have on our protocol, the pneumococcal vaccine is not indicated if any of the following, and one of the check boxes is bone marrow transplant within the last 12 months. Now then, we heard it should be 6 months, and now I'm not sure what I've heard at all. So can you clarify that for me?
Yes, I will. And Jeff, if you'll remind me, I'll send you the link to the guideline that makes that recommendation. The CDC and the Infectious Disease Society of America in 2001 published a guideline that was the guideline's actually entitled Prevention of Infections in Patients Who Have Undergone, bone marrow transplants. And in that guideline, they recommend that you wait 6 months after bone marrow transplant for influenza vaccine and 12 months for the pneumococcal vaccine. Just to make the performance measurement easier, we exclude or consider a, quote, contraindication any patient that's had a bone marrow transplant within the previous year for both vaccines. But the guideline actually says 6 months for influenza, 12 months for pneumococcal.
Okay.
Our next question comes from the line of Leela Hobson, Craven Regional Medical Center. Please proceed.
Hi there, Dr. Bradshaw. I was curious. I think you've kind of already answered my question, but I just wanted to know what if there's any research out there about vaccinating patients in the critical care areas. And I was going by what you had said about that you tend not to vaccinate when they're in the ICU, that kind of thing, and if they're clinically stable. Is there any research that says there's a problem if they do immunize in the ICU or CCU units?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any studies at all for vaccination in that setting. So anything I would say would be completely opinion-based. As a clinician, I tended to avoid it. I guess, the side effects from the vaccines are extremely rare.
Right.
But I also figure that these vaccines at that point in time are completely elective, that, I can wait until the patient is clinically stable. So I tended not to give vaccines to patients who are certainly clinically unstable, but I tended not to give them in the ICU or other settings. There's no risk. There's nothing alive in the vaccine, so you don't have to worry about infecting other patients. Now, that's not the same if you're using the live attenuated vaccine, the nasal vaccine, where if you're dealing with patients that are profoundly immunosuppressed, transplant patients and others, that you do have to worry about using it because you do actually do create a low-grade infection in those patients. So, but for the injectable vaccine, there's no risk. It's just I tend to wait until the patient is clinically stable, but I'm comfortable doing it on the second or third day of hospital stay as long as the patient is clinically stable.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Deborah Santa Maria, Hacksaw Universal Medical. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. This is Linda Aho, one of the nurse practitioners at Hackensack University Medical Center. I have a question again about the exemption of patients that are actively on chemotherapy or radiation therapy. Now, this is not in the present guidelines, and we do not have a question that this could be abstracted to. And also, does this mean both IV and long-term oral chemotherapy?
You know, the question may not be in the manual yet. It's been approved for an update to the measure. It'll only apply to PPV, not influenza.
Right.
And I honestly, right at the moment, I can't tell you how the measure specification will be, but we would basically most likely leave it up to the discretion of the hospital that if the patient was receiving chemotherapy. Now, we wouldn't include corticosteroids or something like that, but
correct. But
actively receiving chemotherapy or radiation therapy, we would exclude the case.
So is it out presently, or we're waiting
I don't think the manual's been updated with that change yet.
Do you know when?
Perhaps July 06, but I'll have to check for you.
Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from the line of Renee Long, WACMED. Please proceed. Renee Long, your line is now open.
Yes, hello. I was actually going to ask the question about the giving at discharge, and I think that question was answered. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Mr. Vodder, there are no further questions at this time.
Okay, Shirley, if you would, we have one question from you to the audience. If you could ask that now, please. And that would be if you would like follow-up from Premier, if you have other questions, to please indicate that by pressing your phone. And that brings us to the end of our time today. I want to thank Dr. Bratzler and Dr. Strickus, and thanks to everyone on the line for participating. Please check your email for a link to our web-based program evaluation. By filling out the evaluation, you'll be able to request more information and suggest other topics for future programs. You can also reach us with additional questions at this email address, and that is advisorlive@premierinc.com. Again, that's advisorlive@premierinc.com. Goodbye from Premier.
All information has been processed. That does conclude the call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.